HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's morning show guest was supposed to be Dr. Thomas Carr, director of the paleontology program at Carthage College. Dr. Carr, unfortunately, is a little bit under the weather, so his visit has been postponed. But we have another really interesting interview to air in its place. Brand new interview just recorded with the author of an intriguing book that is really directed especially at women, but really calls for all of us to live more authentic lives, embracing exactly who we are, warts and all. Stay with us. It is the contention of my morning show guest, Beth Thomas Cohen, that there are way too many of us, and particularly way too many women, who are far too guarded when it comes to being their authentic selves, who feel the need to somehow present to the world a carefully buffered, polished portrait of who they are, incapable or just terribly reluctant to share maybe sort of the darker facets of their lives, their vulnerabilities, what might be viewed as weaknesses. And it is something that she finds for herself debilitating and exhausting, and she's had enough. And she has written a very frank, hard-hitting book to speak to the topic called Drop the Act, It's Exhausting. Free yourself from your so-called put-together life. Beth Thomas Cohen is a very successful member of the fashion industry, and one of her specialties is accessories, and that's we're going to talk about that because she mentions it in the book as being, in a sense, a corollary to what she's talking about here, that in a sense, when one wears some sort of dazzling accessory as part of an outfit, it's partly to say who you are and to say that forthrightly. And in a sense, she wishes that more people could live their lives in terms of the words they speak, the acts they do, to be more authentic, to be more real, to be more unguarded. It's a great book. It's available in paperback from Taylor Trade Publishing. Again, it's called Drop the Act, It's Exhausting. And Beth Thomas Cohen, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me. You explained it perfectly. I need like a re-recorded version of it for everybody.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the compliment. Let me ask you, by the way, this book clearly is written from your own perspective and meant to be shared primarily with women. And I'm trying to remember if at any point in the book you really kind of talk about that, about how this is a little more of a woman thing than a man thing, but obviously this is something that is not entirely exclusive to women. This is probably something that that men, or at least some men, need to think about as well. I read this book and found myself thinking about my own choices and the fact that I find myself imprisoned by many of the same things that you talk about. Can you just say a word about the matter of men versus women, and if this is something all of us to some extent need to think about, why is your book written ostensibly just for women?
Well, I think, first of all, I'm a woman myself, so I think when I set out or when I was writing the book, I inadvertently, of course, am a woman, so I speak from, you know, a very female perspective. However, I love that you love the book. I have a very large group of male friends, as I do female, all of which who have read it. I've had friends' husbands read it with them. And so when I set out to write it, I think, yes, it has a feministic point of view-ish, but I didn't really just want it to be for women. I think they needed to categorize me in my publishing company. And I think I also obviously talk about bearing children, something that obviously men don't do. But I do think that it's for everyone. I really do. I mean, I live my life. I happen to have two young girls, and I teach them all of these things, and they're not, you know, the same age as me, but I feel that this is something that everyone has either continually does or has done in the past or has come across people who do this, and that for me is definitely not a male versus female thing. It's an every person thing, for sure.
Before we talk about some of the specific things you address in the book. I think it would be helpful if our listeners knew a little bit more about who you are, where you come from, both literally and figuratively, and what your life overall sort of looks like. Because I think that makes some difference in terms of how some of these issues have played out in your life, and it helps us understand what your perspective is.
For sure. And I think I have to say, and I want every listener to know, that I would never have felt comfortable. I never knew this is what I'd be doing, first of all. So I would never have been comfortable to put out a novel that the entire free world could possibly read without having lived it, experienced it, or felt that I had a position in order to speak on these things. I think my trouble with a lot of books is when, and unfortunately, even with some of the celebrity books, they live a completely different life than everybody else. So it's difficult sometimes when you're digesting it. For me, I can only speak to the things that I've been involved in, but I come from very diverse backgrounds. So my mother is Caucasian, my father was African-American, and I complicated things by marrying somebody who's Jewish. So I come from kind of little areas of everywhere. I am a product of divorce and remarriage. I have two half-sisters and one real brother. And so I'm kind of a little bit of everybody. And what I always say to everybody is I'm everybody's antichrist. I'm like, you know, oh, she's not enough of this, or she's too much of this. So that's my background. And I grew up in an affluent suburb and happened to be fortunate enough to go to a very good prep school. And that's kind of has molded my view on life and all the different judgments that come with being multicultural and you know, all of those kinds of things. So that's my background.
Explain what you do within the fashion industry, at least at the moment.
Yes, it's an ironic thing compared to the book.
Right.
I mean, it is, because I never, you know, it is. But anyway, I, for a very large portion of my career, I was a fashion editor. I actually didn't even put this in my bio, but I was at Cosmo Girl magazine, which is has merged now with 17 magazine. And then I went into the fashion department when Oprah magazine launched, when Oprah launched her magazine, in the fashion department, specifically in accessories. So basically, in layman terms, I find pretty accessories and put it in the pretty pages of fashion and helped Oprah on her covers, you know, decipher what accessories to use during her shoots and any other fashion shoots. So that's basically what I did. And then I went over to the other side and became a publicist in fashion. So instead of so I just kind of went to the other side. So I then represented the brands that were being used on celebrities in movies and TV and magazines. So I put pretty things on pretty people. That's what I like to say.
Right.
Now I'm not curing cancer, which is probably why I felt like I needed a change.
Exactly. Now, in the book's introduction, you talk about how in a kind of a strange way, the fashion world is a great place for you. You write, the fashion world works. It's an arena in which it does not matter what you are. Everyone is so superficial. All they are looking for is what, or more appropriately, who you are wearing. The superficiality that surrounds me helps me avoid the need to feel I have to label myself. But at the same time, is a world that is defined by the idea that to look good is to feel good. And, of course, that starts to cut close to the heart of the message of your book about authenticity. Say a word more about specifically what you've learned about authenticity in an industry like the fashion industry.
I think, and it's so funny, when you read it, I kind of cringe a little bit and think about all the fashion community that's read the book. And then I think, okay, they're still my friends. Yeah, I think, you know, that I had to really... I was probably 6 years old and I said I wanted to work in the fashion industry because I'm so okay with who I am that I really enjoyed the fashion portion of fashion, which is finding beautiful designers and, you know, really the essence of what fashion is, the expression and all of those things. I really love those things. And then the other part of fashion that you just talked about is all of the things that people a lot of people see but don't say. And I think I know I struggled with a lot of those things. You know, I would sit around a group and borrowing, you know, copious amounts of $80 million worth of jewelry and focusing on shooting a bag story when the bag was $800. And then on the other part of my life, I would think, there are people who can't even afford to buy food. So I always kind of put myself and my scenario in perspective, but I felt like there was something missing. And at the end of the day, there is a huge part of fashion that is like that when you open up magazines and it's fantasy and all those things. But it's a lot of it isn't realistic, not for the average woman or man. And I struggled with that, I think. And I also was able to work under wonderful publications where there was a bigger meaning in their message, the Oprahs of the world or Cosmo Girl kind of, you know, helping infuse positive vibes for teens and young women in their 20s. And then I started my own company, my own PR company, where I could pick designers that I felt were giving back something. So I was fortunate enough to choose and take that sort of path. But, I mean, yeah, that's just the way that it is.
Right. In your introduction, you also make a distinction that I think is really important. You write, "I do want to write a book about honesty, but when I say honest, I am not talking about it in the thou shalt not lie way."
Yeah.
You go on to say, "I'm talking about going against the grain on one of the most obnoxious and insulting pieces of propaganda out there. Act as if."
Yeah.
Tell us why these words that at a glance seem fairly innocuous are, in fact, in your mind, words that really terribly undermine the well-being of men and women everywhere.
Because I think for so many years in my life, I mean, I have this, you know, and I know that sometimes it's off-putting. I have this giant personality and this little body, and that, you know, 9 or 10 years old, that's a lot of person for people to digest. And I quieted myself down in relation to other people because they made me feel like I needed to do so. And once I realized that I wasn't going to live in the box that they put me in, and I came out and realized it's okay if I have these imperfections. Actually, it makes me a hell of a lot more interesting than you, or feeling okay about improper thoughts and realizing if I feel a certain way that that's okay too. And I shouldn't apologize or feel, you know, that I need to be ashamed of how I really feel. And I think that for whatever reason, our society has done such a beautiful job of doing that. I mean, don't you think if we spent a lot more time about actually getting along that we'd be in a much better place? But instead, you know, with social media or whatever it is, we focus on trying to be the version of who we're not. And then we have to spend years in therapy trying to go back to who we think we really are. And why are we doing that?
Right.
Why are we not okay with who we are?
Hmm. You know, I'm so glad that you talked about this because I'm also someone who's on Facebook. I'm on it a lot, and I think I fall prey to the same thing. Although I don't think always for exactly the same reason, but you know, sometimes I think there are certain maybe professional reasons why one does not just air every
Absolutely.
Private vulnerability that you have in a forum like Facebook.
Absolutely.
But the result ends up being the same. I mean, whether it's for that reason or because you're really anxious for the world to think you have your life more together than you do,
right.
the same effect, in a sense, is created that you put to the world this portrait that is not entirely true or not complete. And I've always been more mindful of the harm that might do others in terms of them looking at your life
Yes.
and wondering, oh my God, what's wrong with my life that I don't have it together, that I'm not doing all these exciting things or have
the way
this,
they are.
Right. But you're also pointing out the fact, and this is the thing that's never really occurred to me until I read your book, the harm that's done to the person who is, in a sense, putting out there this slightly artificial, not entirely true portrait of themselves, that they are doing themselves a disservice, not just other people who might be envious of this so-called wonderful
Right.
life.
Right.
Talk more about how the person themselves is undermined when they sort of fall into this trap.
Well, I think my favorite quote of all time, which I it's so funny that you're talking about Facebook. I don't have Facebook, which is insane, I know, and my agent hates me. But I do have Instagram because I like the idea of putting something out there without a lot of fodder back and forth. I'm not good with all the conversation that goes on Facebook. But my favorite quote that I haven't yet used, maybe I'll use today, is be careful who you pretend to be. You might forget who you are.
Mm.
It's my favorite. It's so simple, but it's so true. So I think what we do is there's this our inner self and our inner voice is squashed and manipulated into somebody that we're not in order to kind of feel accepted by other people, which is crazy to me. And I don't really understand why we do it. And clearly on a literal level, the acceptance and all these fitting into a mold. And I mean, when Amy Schumer came out and Lena Dunham and all these amazing, amazing, ridiculously intelligent actresses who started advocating kind of what I'm talking about. Of course, this is in Hollywood, so different genre. I was so thrilled that there was somebody out there that actually was like, hey, I'm okay with who I am, and here are the 15 reasons that I kind of stink. You know what I mean? Like, and feeling really okay with it. And then all of these people started to understand and say, wow, that really resonates with me. So we do ourselves a disservice because even with myself, I had to stop and say, wait a minute, this isn't who I am. Not only is it who I am not, I don't want to be this person. I don't want to be like everybody else. I don't want to be Attack of the Killer Clones in suburbia. I don't want to do that because if I do that, at some point, my relationships are going to suffer. And they did. I picked the wrong group of girlfriends in high school, with the exception, of course, of some good ones. I picked the completely wrong group of friends in college. And then I thought to myself, how did I get here and why? For what reason?
Right. What did you ultimately gain from
absolutely
all of that?
Absolutely nothing.
Right.
I gained bad friends and, you know, and I wasted time. That's how I see it.
Right.
Terrible to say, but it's true.
You go on in your book, of course, to explore specific facets of, in particular, a woman's life, or certainly from a woman's perspective, experiences like being married, having a child, and how it is very, very tempting to keep very guarded the really hard parts of that, the unpleasant parts of that, and maybe the feelings that one is maybe even embarrassed about. And, of course, sometimes with good reason. I mean, it's not that every feeling we have is a great feeling that we should be proud of, but that doesn't mean that the feelings we authentically have should be hidden from the world. I want you especially to say a word about something you experienced, I believe, after the birth of your first child, when you felt this strange and fairly intense dislike of and irritation with your husband. And you really kind of explain how there's a good reason why sometimes a new mother will have these kind of feelings.
Yeah, I mean, I think that even just the realization of a hormonal change of having a child, let alone the day-to-day occurrences that your self goes away completely, at least for, I would say, for the first 12 weeks. And nobody kind of, I think Jenny McCarthy was one of the only people, and I said this to her when I was on her show, she was one of the only people that actually said, hey, you know, here's where we really are. But yeah, I thought I really did have this picture like, of course it's going to be hard, and but we're going to fall so much more in love and this and that. And we did. We did all of those things. We felt like this is a miracle. This is amazing. But I also felt like I wanted to go into the corner with a straitjacket and 12 bottles of wine and hand the baby over to my husband and have them leave for like a month. I mean, I really just needed a minute, and I needed him to feel and be all the things that I was, and he didn't bear the actual child. He didn't have the hormonal changes. I was angry at him for getting me pregnant to begin with. I mean, these are all normal emotions. They didn't stay. They came and went. They still come and go, by the way. I had that feeling about him this morning. And I love him dearly, but these are normal things, and there's no reason. And I don't care what anyone says. Every single person, every woman at that stage, at some point, goes through that, whether one is more extreme than the other. That is just the way that it is. And I was surrounded by, you know, like my girlfriends are very similar to me in that way, but then I would walk out, and I'd go into these mommy and me classes, and I'd see the woman, like, fully hair done, perfectly coiffed, no belly, perfect jeans. And I thought to myself, I can barely get myself out of bed. this cannot, am I not normal? Is she normal and I'm supposed to be this way? I just felt that all of these things, all these imperfections, you know, it was just another stage in life where I was led to believe that I was supposed to feel a certain way, and I didn't. And it scared me a little bit. Hmm. And then I realized my norm is the norm. My norm is the norm, not the girl, you know, at the Mommy and Me class who has her hair blown out.
Right. You also go on to say that and in some ways this is probably where even more harm perhaps is done to oneself and to others, is when one chooses to put before the public or share with one's friends only the most positive, glowing accounts of one's own child and how talented they are, how skillful they are, how wonderful they are in every single way.
And then they give a trophy for that.
Right, right. And that has to be scary in the sense of being a cycle that's very difficult to break, I should think. I mean, and in a sense, a mother is probably really stepping out on a limb when they choose for whatever reason to be more honest about their own child's shortcomings.
Totally. And then you think to yourself, is my child supposed to be doing that? Why isn't my child doing that? Why isn't my child able to, you know, like everything else I discuss in the book. It's a measure of how good or bad you are. And I think that's just ridiculous because at the end of the day, there is no way that is really how it's supposed to be. And then you end up questioning yourself. And the worst part about it is these things are stages. So as you're going through the stages of 3 months, you know, 4 months eating solid foods and 6 months sitting up and 8 months crawling and 1 year walking, you're going through all of these things. But while you're going all through all of the milestones, each milestone brings more masks with women that you would be around. So it was just, I find still to this day, very confusing. I have a 9-year-old in fourth grade, and I was asking around because she needed, we're looking for a math tutor. And I had a mom say, oh, she needs a tutor in fourth grade already? And I turned to her, and what I wanted to do was use multiple profanities, but I didn't because we were standing in the schoolyard, and that wouldn't help anything. But I thought to myself, see, that quiet bit of judgment right there, I'm not so into that. Mm. I'm not, like, that is, that, those are, so you're going through the milestones with your children, but you're going through the judgmental milestones with other women, or men for that matter, and so it's very exhausting. Hmm. It's very exhausting, and I just refused to do. I was just not going to play that game. I wasn't.
I think that what is especially troubling about this kind of practice is not just what it does to the mother herself and her fellow mothers or others in her immediate circle, but of course one thinks about what that ends up doing to the child and to other children. I mean, they seem, I mean, it's one thing, and it's a bad thing, but it's one thing when you harm yourself and your own sense of well-being and self-worth. It's quite another thing when an innocent child ends up being the victim of that.
Yeah, and I think what I just put, actually, this is an Instagram thing I just put up the other day about, well, there's a profanity in it, so I'm not going to say it, but it was coming back to the area that I grew up in and running into, you know, let's say blank people, women, and then they're procreating the same type of children that they are. And I thought to myself, wow, you know, there's no kind of, you didn't learn anything from your own growth experience or growing up. And the children really, it does such a detriment to the children. And then when your child is trying to navigate those types of children, it's very difficult. It's very difficult. And you're trying to instill, you know, these specific types of values and this kind of open-mindedness. And then, you know, you're constantly battling those same people who now have children. So the only people that are really, really going to suffer, like you said, are the kids.
Right.
And it's very, I find, extremely confusing for everybody. I mean, I think, you know, my agent and I talk, I'm definitely going to want to write another book, and what, I have so many things to say in so many different areas, but I'm finding so many acts that begin in those kind of preteen, teen years that I would like, hopefully I can help navigate with my own children to not do or practice so that, you know, they don't have to live their life like that and wait until they're, you know, 40 to put out a book and discuss it with everybody else.
Right. So you have a whole chapter devoted to pregnancy and how it makes so much more sense for a woman to be very, very honest about what they are experiencing in pregnancy, including all the stuff that can be very, very difficult, very, very
I'm sure
unpleasant.
You enjoyed that chapter.
Right. Well, I did learn a lot, I got to say. And of course, this chapter beyond that we've just touched on in terms of talking about once the child is born, how soon they're walking, how soon they're reading, how soon they're doing this and that. At one point in this chapter called My Baby Can Read, you write this, and I'm very intrigued by this. In my opinion, parenting is not something that is compartmentalized. Dropping the various acts we've picked up along the way in the parenting realm can help us remember that everything is an opportunity to grow our children.
Yeah.
Explain what you're talking about here, how the acts, the inauthenticity that we've been talking about, how that can, I suppose, I guess it must compartmentalize our parenting a little bit in some way. How does that happen? And then how does dropping the inauthenticity lead to this other approach to parenting that you think makes more sense?
I think that my issue, there's so many things. I think, and I'm trying to read other books too, because I'm in the throes of this as we speak, because I do have a 9-year-old. I have a 5-year-old, but really my 9-year-old is going through it. I think that one of the things that I find very difficult is we live in such a different world today with our own children and my generation than we did 30 years ago when I was a child. We just live in a different world. It's, you know, when it comes to safety, and I mean, there's just a plethora of different things. And so what I try to instill with my girls is that I don't necessarily believe that I don't want my child at school to have an altercation with a child and obviously ever get physical or use profanity. I mean, some things are just a no. But I also don't think that if someone is being, you know, with intervention and whatever it is, nasty to something, I don't think my daughter has to be so nice to them either. So I think what we've done in society is created these children and said, just be nice to everybody, don't do this. And I think it does a disservice because you go out into the real world and you think, oh, this will work, but it doesn't. It doesn't work. So I'm trying to set up my kids to realize, without the true realities of being an adult, what life will be like for them so there won't be those surprises as they get older. Like I speak about, you know, competition and sports and intramural sports and giving children trophies for losing at the age of 10 or 11. And to me, it does a disservice to the child because life doesn't work that way. Sometimes you either win or you lose, and there's no way to differentiate that. It's either one. And so to set up for failure, to be okay to come home with a test that's a 65, to not feel like you need to get A's all the time, to not have to go to the Ivy League, to play on your strengths and work on your weaknesses, to find out if you're a creative person and math doesn't come, you know, easily to you, that's okay, that you don't need to compete with other kids. I mean, there's so many things, but that's kind of what I'm talking about. You know, we don't even realize that we're doing it. And there's so many pressures from other moms and teachers and schools that we lose sight of the actual part when the kid needs to be a kid. I don't think they need to be in activities 5 days a week. You know, I think that there's a happy medium. And for whatever reason in our climate of the world today, we've lost a lot of that. I mean, do you not remember opening up the door and playing outside? Okay, we might not be able to go anywhere we want anymore because of the climate of the world, but they can still turn off a television. They don't need their iPad, and they can play in the yard for 5 hours. You know, I think we've gone away from that for whatever reason, and I'm trying to kind of – I want my kids to understand those pressures of the world, but in a way that's digestible for her when she's 9, you know?
We're speaking with Beth Thomas-Cohen about her book, Drop the Act, It's Exhausting. Free yourself from your so-called put-together life. Do you have time for a couple more questions?
Totally.
Great. I'm enjoying this very,
yeah,
very much.
Absolutely. Me too.
Great. One of the most intriguing chapters in the book is Chapter 5, called The Act, 40 is the New 20, in which you are talking about how there seems to be a widespread attitude among, I suppose, maybe women especially, I guess I can think of a couple of guys in my life that maybe do this as well, in which they are trying to put the best possible face on whatever age they are, and often in ways that sort of shift the clock back. I mean that you know that it's okay to be 40 because 40 now is really more like 20, and it's okay to be 60 because that's really what 40 used to be, and so on. The sense that it's easier for us to stay healthier and better fit in older ages, and so none of the old myths about the travails of growing older in fact are there. And what you're suggesting is that while maybe there's a grain of truth to some of that, we tend to fall into a trap of desperately wanting to pretend that we're not getting older, or that getting older holds no drawbacks or pain at all, when in fact, of course, it inescapably does.
Yeah.
Tell us more about especially how this has played out in your own life.
Well, it's really interesting to me, and I'm, of course, being honest. When I wrote the book, I really love this chapter. I didn't realize this chapter would resonate so kind of across the board, and it really did. I think InStyle did a piece on it. It wasn't to me, it didn't jump out as much. I really felt like everyone should just feel this way, and I didn't realize it really just kind of people were, you know, really liked this chapter. So I just turned 40 in September, and now I know so there are people who have a kind of, quote, age thing, and then there's people who don't have an age hang-up. I don't have an age hang-up or whatever. But I also think that I live in a world, especially when I was, you know, in the fashion industry, in media, which I'm sure you can attest to, and just, you know, then in the real world of moms or whatever, dads, and seeing and having conversations, and it's very difficult for me to understand why 40 can't just be 40. It can be 40 and you feel 20, you know, you still party and hang out with your friends and you work out and all those stuff. You don't have to feel 40. But why do we need to set ourselves up for failure where it needs to be 40 is the new 20? Can't 40 just be 40 and 40's great and you feel 20? So I have a really difficult time understanding that. And so many fashion stories, beauty stories, celebrity stories are surrounded by look great in your 20s, look great in your 30s, look great in your 40s. And I just think it's just kind of disgusting and also really not true. Like, I'm sorry, I don't look 20. I look good, but I don't look 20. I don't want to look 20. I don't want to look 20. I loved being 20 when I was 20. Yeah, would I jump back in a time capsule and go back to college and party all night? Totally. But I would want to then come back to my 40s because I don't want to be 20 again. I want to feel good at 40. I want to look the best I can. I want to eat well. I want to exercise. But I want 40 to be what it is, which is 40. And there's, just so everybody knows, you can pretend and you can try to scalpel it all, but we know you're not 20.
In this chapter, you take a moment to talk about, you know, kind of the fluffy notion of loving oneself and loving who you are, but you really put some teeth on it, I have to say. I mean, I really like the way you kind of approach this. It's not nearly so touchy-feely as we sometimes get in other books or in other approaches. At one point in this chapter, you quote someone you say is an English director, Marcus Gadould, who wrote something so interesting to an older woman who had written to him for some advice. And she at the time was 35 years old, by the way. And you tell us that his response to her was this: "You need to start seeing yourself as a process, not as a memory or as a collection of traits. You are treating yourself as an ossified, finished fossil that cannot be changed or improved." You go on to say that these words really powerfully resonated with you. That is, you could see yourself in those words.
Yeah, I you know, and I think, again, probably some of my fashion experience, it's trying to alter the inevitable. And, you know, I do believe, listen, you want to go under the knife and do whatever you want. I am so for all of those things. I think that we just need to make sure that we're doing those things for the right reasons. And for so long, you know, I am not the cookie cutter person. I look different than a lot of other people. I'm shaped differently than a lot of people. I mean, I'm not using the Kardashian situation or liking or not liking it, but what was liberating for me was that time when kind of Kim came out and the Beyoncés came out. I'm just using them as physical examples in terms of bodies, where people started appreciating curves and all of those things, and that's who I have been my entire life. And so I think I searched for the me's of the world, or was there somebody else that looked and felt like me, because I didn't feel like the norm. And so when I read that, it just resonated to me, because I needed to be accepting of not only who I was as a person, but who I was physically, and what that, you know, what that age process was going to be like for me. You know, we joke around all the time. My mom and I joke. My mom is the one that's Caucasian, and we joke around all the time, and she'll say to me, oh, you know, thank God your dad was black, because look at your skin. And we joke around about it. I mean, that's all we can do, is be lighthearted about it, because we always laugh about the aging process, and we have a little bit of humor to it. But I finally kind of, you know, listen, I am not perfect. I need to drop my act. I check myself. I overly analyze things. I think I look like crap one day. I mean, I am not like this all the time. I strive to be this person most of the time, but we all have difficult days. But that quote said to me, okay, hold on for a second. This needs to happen gracefully, and I can't stop it. You know, no matter what I do, I can't get off the train. This is where I'm going, and so is everybody else.
I am really glad we will have time to talk about Chapter 6, which is called Sticks and Stones May Break My Bones, But Words Will Never Hurt Me.
Yeah, it's my favorite chapter.
One of the things that I think is important to talk about here is the fact that that phrase is interesting to quote in a book that is written in a very frank style, and in which you are, among other things, telling women to be much more free and open about what they say, to not be quite so guarded, quite so buffered when it comes to what you say about yourself and even about what you say about other people. So what is this chapter doing in the middle of such a book in which, you know, you talk about how hurtful words can be? To what extent does this run a little contrary to kind of the prevailing attitude of the book?
Well, I think everybody needs to realize, because sometimes when I do interviews or I'm in the media or they read stuff on the book, is that my book, there's three really important things. The first thing is I don't place judgment in my book. I open up a can of worms and I say, let's talk about this. So I don't ever say this is how you have to live your life. I give antidotes and I say, let's all have this conversation. What do you think? So that's the first thing. The second thing is, it comes from a place of yes, not a place from no. So I come with an open heart with my book. I don't point fingers. I open up with my open heart. So when I say have these conversations and I say be your authentic self, I don't mean you need to be a, you know, blank. You know, I want you to come from a place of yes, and a good person. I want open conversations, but I don't want anybody to feel like they need to do it in a negative, mean way. And the third thing is, this is a learning process for every person, including myself. And like I said, you're not going to read the book and then your act is going to be fully dropped and your whole entire life is going to change. I mean, it's a process that we all need to live through. Me included. And so when I talk about the sticks and stones part about it, there is a couth and a delivery to the way that people need to interact with each other. And we have completely lost that as a society. I mean, is anybody watching the political race? I mean, really, we have completely lost that. And so when I say how you feel and talk about how you feel, I don't mean put people down and come from a negative place. I say, please, let's have this conversation. Let me get off my chest what's bothering me. Here is how I feel. How do you feel? And how can we move past it? So the sticks and stones, it resonates with me, because for so many different stages of my life, being different and having all this adversity, I had to deal with a lot of negative still. I mean, I walked into Starbucks with Lila, my little one, the other day, who's platinum blonde, and everybody thinks I'm the nanny. And I mean, this is where I live. Okay, I live 8 miles outside of Manhattan. So I'm not in, Mississippi. I'm in, right. I'm in New Jersey. I'm in 8 miles away from the city. So, you know, I've had to deal with a lot of negative racial comments, religious comments now that I married somebody outside of my own faith. I've heard socioeconomic things and judgments. So I've been very affected by that. I've been very affected by words that my father used to use when my parents got divorced. What you say sticks with people. And it's very, very difficult because we all fall prey and we all say things we don't mean, but we need to correct it when we do it and we need it to stop. Because what people don't understand is words are way more powerful than ever using any type of physical, into any type of physical altercation. And so, yes, while I say, speak the truth, you know, talk about who you really are, feel comfortable about those things, come from a place of yes, a place of bettering yourself or the person. I don't want judgment or, I don't want it to come from a place of no, of negativity. That is absolutely not what I'm saying.
Right.
This is a place of yes to make you feel and be a better person and have better relationships. So that's where that comes from. And I think that people really don't realize how powerful words can be.
Right. I think it's important that you make that point, and you make it very well. It does come right ahead of what might be for some people the toughest part of the book, or what would for them in their own lives be one of the toughest things to do. And that is when you really call for people to speak much more frankly and honestly with their own friends, including those friends who maybe shouldn't be friends anymore, or in fact are not friends anymore, but are still part of your circle. But maybe people who, in one way or another, actually are more a detriment to your life and your happiness than they are a help. But that process, of course,
is incredibly
difficult.
Yeah.
And part of what makes it difficult is that everybody's a little different. Not only the person who might be trying to act on your advice, but the friend or so-called friend with whom they might be saying something really difficult. It's really hard to know how that's going to be received or the effect that it's going to have.
Yeah. It's really hard. And I think that I think this is such a simple thing, but I really do believe if it's that difficult, then something is not right. I feel that the simplicity of relationships, whether or not you go through difficult challenges with a friend or a marriage or a family member, that is par for the course. That is part of life, you know, navigating through conflict and resolving it and figuring it out. But if it is always that difficult, then something's missing. Something's not right. And it took me a lot of relationships and a lot of friendships to figure that out. And I think I innately knew it in my subconscious because I just did. And I chose to kind of ignore it, which infuriates me now. But that's also part of the growing up process. I think if you got to trust your gut. So if it feels off and that friend or feels difficult to interact with, speak with, if they've done, you know, whatever it is, I think that the majority of the time, your interpersonal relationships should be easy. That's I really think it's that simple. I'm not saying eliminate everybody, but there's something to be said for that because, we are here one time and one time only. We live one life. One life. So, and we learn from our experiences. So if I've learned anything in the world, it is not to conform to a norm of something that I don't even believe in or want to be in order to fit into whatever mold somebody would like to put me. And that was a really hard pill for me to swallow. And I think I swallowed it a lot earlier than a lot of other people, which is what made me capable of writing the book. But I think that is a very important lesson that if it's that difficult, of course, family is family, so we are stuck with them no matter what. But, and that's fine. But, you know, when it comes to friendships and marriages or whatever, that it shouldn't be that hard.
Right.
It shouldn't.
You're touching on sort of what is seems to be an attitude pervasive in the culture, and you talk at one point about how the media has played an enormous role in creating some of these attitudes. You say media banks on the fact that women have so little self-confidence that they will act like other people, namely celebrities, in order to be accepted. Mm-hmm. Talk about the joke being on all of us.
Yeah,
of course, go ahead.
I think that the problem is, the celebrity doesn't even do it. Society does. So that's the part that I think that's so difficult for us to really, you know, of course, there are going to be a group of people would throw out and say, oh, they're just about money and fame. Okay, yes, that might be true. But there are a plethora of people in the media, you know, celebrities or, you know, TV personalities who don't ask for that position. They're simply put there. And I think that's the part that I have a difficult time when it comes to the media, because I'm sure you see it. I've seen it. You know, words get misconstrued and twisted and this and that. And I think that it's really difficult, you know, that and we have such an interest in it, because the more they put out, the more we want to know. And I think it's kind of disgusting. You know, it's kind of disgusting. And I think that we, you know, part of it is, you know, what they say, if there's a rumor, there's some truth to it or whatever. But some of it is just, I think, you know, fodder, just, you know, flames and fire. And it's a very difficult thing. I think as adults, we're able to digest, you know, some of the realities and some of the not, you know, some of the things that aren't realities. But girls and boys in at certain ages are not.
Hmm.
They're not. I have a 9-year-old who came home one day and told me that somebody called her fat and that she'd like to have a flat stomach like Demi Lovato. And I thought to myself, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? Demi Lovato is not standing out there telling everybody to have a flat stomach. She's out there advocating for everyone to be that. You know, her message is so different than what's perceived. But the kids don't see that. And we as a medium do a disservice in the world of not squashing some of those things. And I think that that's a huge problem.
Right.
And it's potentially going to be a much larger problem. I mean, like I said, look at the presidential debate. Either way you fall, it's just kind of a nightmare.
Right. What's being said and the way it's being said. Absolutely. I appreciate that towards the end of the book, you say it's important for us to be outspoken about being outspoken, that we need to make sure that we make this really, really clear. You write at one point, the idea that so many women are not saying what's on their minds is what I believe to be the root of an insidious identity crisis. We are hiding ourselves. And of course, your book calls for people to stop that life is too short to spend it hiding who you really are.
I think
your book does a wonderful job of encouraging women and men, for that matter, as well, to think about the ways in which they can live more openly and authentically. I imagine this is something you're still working on yourself.
Oh my God, I really check myself every single day. I do, and I think that I have to remember that just because I'm this way, the majority of the world doesn't work this way. So I can fall prey to it all the time. And I have to remember, that's why I really, truly surround myself around people who I don't, you know, not all my friends are, quote, like me, but we're like-minded in our openness and lack of judgment and acceptance. Because if I surrounded myself around the people that aren't like that, then I would be changing myself again.
Hmm.
I'd be masking myself again. And I don't want to do that. But I'm thrown into a community and a world that lives that way.
Right. Well, maybe not much longer, at least if you have anything to say about it. Your book, again, is called Drop the Act. It's exhausting. Free yourself from your so-called put-together life, published by Taylor Trade Publishing. Beth Thomas-Cohen, I enjoyed your book, and I so enjoyed this opportunity to speak with you. Very best wishes to you, and thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Again, we were expecting a visit today from Dr. Thomas Carr. He had to postpone his visit because of not feeling well. But we look forward to having him on the morning show in the very near future.